Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about the lottery schedules. We had this idea of proportional share that we started with this idea of just being fair. And one notion of being fair is that, oh, if everyone has an equal chance of being chosen, that seems fair. So this one idea of being fair. And the lottery scheduler started with this idea, but then we said, well, maybe we don't want it to be quite that even. Maybe we have some sort of preference, so we can express this as sort of, if you're twice as important, you're twice as likely to get chosen. And we had this idea that basically you're in a lottery where everyone had a certain number, or thread has a certain number of lottery tickets, and that's how we make our scheduling decision. And you mentioned that, you know, this is a very elegant algorithm. It's very simple in terms of bookkeeping. You know, we just have to keep track of the number of tickets, and it's very flexible because we can set that number of tickets in all sorts of ways, depending on what our sort of overall goals are. But the randomness maybe, you know, is not something you actually want in practice, because it means that even though over the long term things work out well as far as the overall ratios, the short term variation can be a lot, just because that's how random choices work. Then we talked about this idea of shortest remaining time first. So we mentioned before that, oh, if I want to optimize turnaround time, which is kind of this proxy for how responsive is my system to like user input, you know, we want to run the shortest CPU burst first. We learned that, oh, there's this little detail that if I'm worried about, you know, starting something in the middle of some other CPU burst, I don't want to look at how long the overall CPU burst is, but how much time is left. And that's going to be where I make my trade-off. If I run the shorter thing with less time left, then I'm going to delay things less than if I run the thing with more time left. So I always want to run the thing with the least time left every time, you know, I could choose something to run. Now, we saw that, oh, you know, this idea of remaining time or even the CPU burst length, you know, in our examples, I just told you, oh, we ran these threads, which use the CPU for this long, and that's nice, but that's not actually something we get to know in practice. Then in practice, the length of the CPU burst varies, and there's certainly nothing you do when writing a program to tell the OS, you know, I'm going to have long or short or medium CPU bursts. The OS needs to somehow figure that out. And we saw one idea for a way of both figuring that out, sort of at least guessing that in a good way, and also implementing something like SRTF. And this was a multi-level feedback queue. So here, we'll maintain an estimate of your CPU burst length, and we'll store that estimate as your process's current priority setting. And we'll kind of enforce that estimate by, at each priority setting, we'll limit your time quantum to about your estimate of CPU burst length. So if we're wrong in the direction where you use too much time, you'll use your whole time quantum, and we'll take action to lower your priority in that case. And if we're wrong in the other direction and you use a lot less than your time quantum, we'll take action and raise your priority in that case. And in this way, we're kind of adjusting automatically to set your priority, which is also our estimate of your CPU bursts, to match your last CPU burst. So this is under the assumption that your program has these consistent amounts of CPU it uses every time it needs to run. And we just find that naturally, and we kind of couple that with our logic for actually deciding what to run. And we're not really keeping track of that much extra state, we're just keeping track of a priority number, which, you know, we might already do for other scheduling algorithms you might want to implement. Mentioned that since this multi-level feedback queue idea is a priority-based scheduler, and we're setting priorities in a particular way, well, we have starvation. And it's something we generally see when we use these priority-based schedulers, that if there's a way of you being at the lowest priority, well, probably that can happen. And if that happens, if there's enough other things going on in the system, probably you never get to run, or essentially never get to run. So there are real schedulers which are based on this multi-level feedback queue idea, and one of the things they, you know, definitely need to do something about is this starvation problem. They need some sort of adjustment to make sure that programs, you know, don't never get to run for a very, very long time. And this is especially important because we're setting the priority based on this kind of guess, right? That we're assuming that the program is going to have a long CPU burst if it's at a low priority, but that might not be true. So then we looked at Linux's scheduler, or Linux's default scheduler. I should say Linux supports a whole lot of schedulers, and this, the default has changed over the years, so which is the completely fair scheduler. And this, instead of starting with, we want to implement this priority scheme, it started with, we want to implement a sort of fairness, and we want to do that in a deterministic way. So what we'll track is what we call this virtual runtime idea, that we track basically how long each thread has run, and the thing which has run the least gets to run next. And this is fair in a certain sense. And we saw that, you know, if programs just wanted to use the CPU all the time, we just get round robin here. That we, you know, we set some sort of time quantum, we look to schedule something, we say, okay, we're gonna schedule it, you know, in the next, schedule it now, it's gonna use some time, it's virtual time is gonna increase, so something else is gonna have the lowest virtual time, and it will go in this sort of ABC, ABC pattern that we saw. We have, say, three threads, A, B, and C, just like with round robin. Where things are different is when threads are doing I/O, they get some sort of credit for the time they're doing I/O. Where basically, you know, once you stop doing I/O, you're more eligible to use the processor because, well, you weren't using it before while you were doing the I/O. And we saw also that we kind of needed to limit the advantage that that had. Because if we did the sort of extreme version of this, then this meant that, you know, if I had a program wait an hour for a key press, you know, if we just did the natural thing, it could run for an hour without ahead of all the other programs. That's not what we want, so we choose some amount of extra time we want it to run based on having waited for an hour for that key press. And I also alluded to the fact that CFS is going to support proportional sharing, and we'll look at exactly the simple change that's done for that to support that today. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So we were talking about CFS. Let's do a little exercise here. Let's say I have two programs, A and B, and A wants to use the CPU all the time, so it's just doing some big computation for effectively forever. And B is going to use the CPU and then do something which takes, with like I/O, which takes 1.5 milliseconds, then use the CPU for a millisecond and so on. So it runs this pattern. So based on this, assuming we ignore like the adjustments for waking from sleep, so we just assume that we say, you know, if you had 1 unit of virtual time before you started waiting, then when you finish waiting, you're also going to have 1 unit of virtual time. We're not going to try to adjust that up. About what amount of the CPU does A get? A minute or so, check with your neighbors.
Yeah, I think it's something that's
Okay, so who would like some more time? Someone want to volunteer an estimate? Sure.
We heard the state of things, we use about 66% of the CPU time because.
Okay, so you think it gets about 2/3?
Yes.
Okay, so what was the calculation for that?
So every time that A runs, or A will always have less or more virtual runtime than B because B doesn't get any credits when it's doing I/O. So B will always get to run whenever it wants, but because there's a 1 millisecond time quanta, whenever A runs, B will still have like half a second of I/O left, and A will do one more slot, so A does two.
Okay, so your proposal is that, okay, so your first observation, which is I think a very important one, is that, oh, when B is doing its 1.5 milliseconds of I/O, we're not going to leave the CPU idle. So we're going to run A, and A is going to use at least 1.5 milliseconds, which is more than B has used to set up that 1.5 millisecond wait. So A is always, after we get started, going to have more virtual runtime than B, which means that B, whenever we decide to make a scheduling decision, always gets to run instead of A if B is runnable. So that's a key observation. So B gets priority over A. And then you're saying, okay, well, we have this 1 millisecond time quanta, so what's going to happen is B is going to run, and then A is going to run for one time quanta, and then A is going to run for another time quanta while B finishes its I/O, and then B gets to run, and we repeat that pattern. Okay, and that's how you got 2/3. So the assumption you're making here is that if B becomes runnable in the middle of a time quantum, then A can't run. So I think that's another assumption. This seems right. So there's a question here, like, this situation actually is not very desirable here, that we've determined that under our policy, you know, our policy is that B, you know, should run instead of A. Of A, so we would like to preempt A. So the question is, should we do that? You know, we'd like to preempt A in this case, right? Where we've observed that B like is generally considered to be much more needy for CPU than A. And I haven't talked about what does CFS do for that. And CFS has this sort of heuristic where it basically says, if you're enough ahead of the virtual runtime, we'll preempt it, otherwise we won't. So I didn't tell you that, so I wouldn't expect you to know it, but under that assumption, you know, once things get going, B's virtual runtime will be so much lower than A's that we will say, look at, you know, B became runnable and say, oh, we should preempt A, it's more important. There's some heuristics for that. This is a tricky decision. So what happens in practice is we get this schedule, but which is, in fact, a little more than 2/3. Sorry, a little less than 2/3 goes to A. We get, so 3/5. So I'll write our two good answers here. So we have 2/3 if we enforce the quanta, and we get this 3/5 if we preempt. If we say, hey, B became runnable, let's get rid of A because B needs CPU so much more than A. Our metric is, you know, B has been starved of CPU, we should fix that. Questions on these answers, comments, other answers?
Which one does CFS use on Linux?
So CFS has a has a way of deciding to sometimes preempt, which is based on basically, you know, we want it for cases like this, we would want to preempt. I'm not actually sure exactly what the heuristic is. So there's some threshold, and I'm not sure when exactly it's triggered. And CFS sets quanta in a different way than this 1 millisecond way. Yes? Preemption is a case-by-case basis for CFS. So for CFS, if B becomes runnable and its virtual runtime is very close to A, we don't want to preempt because we're just doing extra context switches for not making things much more fair. So that's why CFS has this sort of guess that we should preempt if there's a big difference, but not if there's a small difference. Does that answer your question? Okay, I thought I had the other version of this exercise. I did not do that. Okay, so I didn't make the slide I wanted to. So we're gonna work up to this exercise, but before we do that, let's do first do a simpler version of this, where instead of this B, let's say I have B just uses the CPU forever. So let's start with that. So if B uses the CPU forever, like A was in the first example, we have this pattern for A. So we'll start with that, and then we'll go to this version where A and B both have this complicated pattern. So if B uses the CPU forever, how much of the CPU time does A get? And I think the first thing you should think about is we observed in the previous example that B was always behind A in how much virtual time it had. And do we have a similar situation with A versus B here? Is A always going to be behind B in how much virtual time it has as the thing that waits for A? Someone have some way we can start on answering this with the B running, trying to use all the CPU case? Some starts? Yeah.
If B is running forever, it will start off alternating A and B 1 millisecond each, and then it will subject A's IO, B will run twice in a row, but then it will run A twice in a row to catch up with B.
Okay, so you're saying 50% because of how our virtual runtime works. That if B has not used, so first of all, observe that, you know, if we let A keep running and then only run B in A's gaps, then we have a problem with our virtual runtime. And that problem is that B is always going to have less virtual runtime, so that's not what we're going to do. We're going to, at some point when A wants to run and B wants to run, we're going to have to choose B. And we're going to keep choosing B until its virtual runtime becomes equal to A, which is going to give us this 50-50 mix. So we'll end up with about a 50-50 split over the long term. It's true that, of course, B is going to run more when A is doing IO, and proportionally less when A is not doing IO, but the sort of overall is going to be 50-50, because that's sort of what this virtual runtime metric does if we don't make adjustments for when things wait for IO. So questions on that idea, equalizing virtual runtime? Yes? How long are we assuming A and B run for each of those alternations? So he was assuming 1 millisecond, but I would argue it doesn't really matter. Because what's going to happen is that if because of like our time quanta, we choose to run A a bunch more, we're going to correct that later because the virtual runtimes will be imbalanced. And therefore, we'll have more cases where we'll choose B instead if A ran for too long, or vice versa. Does that answer your question? So what I'd say is that, like, he was imagining a specific schedule, but we don't need to think about a specific schedule for this. We know that if we do any sort of schedule where A gets a lot more, gets really ahead of B, we're going to fix that later because B is going to be able to run to resolve that. And if we run a schedule where B gets a lot ahead of A, A can run enough to fix that later to get ahead of, Does that answer your question? Okay, so we answered this question for our simplified example. So let's now go through this original exercise. And think about how it applies here. And I think a key observation to make is that B can't use half the CPU. Right, if we just ran B, it wouldn't use half. So our previous answer when B was using all the CPU was A would get half the CPU. But that shouldn't be the case because B can't do that. So give you a bit of time. So who would like some more time? A couple of people.
second. So it was remarkable.
So if the weights, like something else are going to come over that.
Okay, who'd like some more time still? Okay, so someone want to volunteer sort of an answer or the start of an answer? Like, or what direction you think about what's going on here versus our previous problem? I was hoping that 3 feet, but okay, sure. So you think A gets 40%?
Yeah. And my reasoning was that B is going to still be way behind A.
Okay, so your reasoning is B is way behind A. And a way we can think of that is that, you know, if B was running alone, you know, B is just not using most of the CPU. And A is going to use more of the CPU just because A has more stuff to do. So B's virtual time is sort of naturally less than A's. So that should mean that, you know, B generally gets priority.
So we're still
going to
run B whenever we can.
So you're saying, okay, probably that means we essentially end up running B whenever we can. So B gets 40%?
Right, but then beyond that, so now A has 3/5 of the time to deal with, but some of that time it's going to be waiting for IO.
Okay. So you're saying, okay, so that means that, so B is greater than A for virtual time. Greater than A because B uses less virtual time. So B gets 40% everything it wants. And therefore A gets at most 60%. So A gets 60% minus the time that B runs that's not during A's IOs. And that would be an answer I agree with. And I don't have a precise estimate of what that is, but that's sort of, that tells you sort of the intuition you want for thinking about this, right? Is that, you know, we get 50-50 is what we do if everything was using the CPU all the time. And otherwise, we're kind of making adjustments to deal with, oh, if you didn't use all your time, we're going to kind of split that up in a way that, you know, prioritizes what's left. Yes? Sorry, the 40, what about the 40%? Where's the 40% come from? That is, the cycle for B is this, is we have 1 ms of CPU every 2.5 ms, and that gives us 40%. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. I have my written out solution. Okay, so... so I alluded to earlier that we also handle proportional sharing. So the way CFS does that is we just, when we're recording virtual runtime, we have the option of, if some program is more important, we can multiply that by a weight. And we can say, your virtual runtime counts for half of every other program. And that means you get to run twice as much. You're entitled to twice as much CPU. So every time you take a millisecond of CPU, that's like another program taking half a millisecond. And so that's how you can do proportional sharing. Okay, so that gives... CFS stuff, and I guess so... there's some other parts of CFS we didn't talk about in detail. So one that I just skipped over because I have slides on is quantum length selection and preemption logic. So CFS has something about choosing that quantum length. So I just like showed a fixed millisecond, but CFS actually chooses it based on the number of programs that are active and also has some logic to do preemption. And there's some other features. So probably the trickiest one, I just have like one bullet for dealing with multiple CPUs, but that's probably like most of the scheduler because it's complicated. And I'm not saying CFS has a really elegant solution for that, but obviously you need to handle multiple cores on anything recently. And also there's things about, what about groups of related tasks? So we've kind of treated all threads as equal, but if we think of like a system like say Portal, we actually probably want to do something different than that. We want to like look at like be able to like group a user's programs together or something like that. And CFS has support for doing that sort of thing in its scheduling. And so we've done this sort of looking at specifically this Linux scheduler, and it seems like this is a strange design. It's different than all the other schedulers we talked about. So, like, is it really interesting to learn? And there are actually some schedulers which are similar to it. So one is that the way CFS works is very similar to the deterministic version of the lottery scheduler that the people who wrote the original lottery scheduler design came up with later. It's not the same thing, but it's a very similar idea. And it's also similar to scheduling that's been around for forever. Well, not forever, but since 1989 at least, in networking for scheduling data going over a network. It's basically that algorithm, but applied to processors. Which sort of shows that, you know, some of the things we learn, you know, they apply in surprisingly different domains because it's still a scheduling problem. It's still a what do we do next problem that we see in lots of different computer systems out there. So questions about CFS? Okay, or schedulers in general? So I have my summary slide on schedulers of the ones we've seen. And then I'll have a brief note about multi-core scheduling. So if you care about CPU throughput, we learned first come, first serve. Just don't do context switches. If you care about average responsiveness, like approximate shortest remaining time first. You're not going to actually do shortest remaining time first because we can't. We don't know how long things run, but you can approximate. If you care about I/O throughput, like how making sure that like we completely use a disk, you want to have things do that race to sleep thing. If you care about sort of fairness in terms of like overall CPU usage, CFS like kind of does that sort of thing. If you care about fairness in terms of, you know, equal chance to run when you're runnable, that's more like round robin. And if you care about like favoring certain users, that sort of thing, you want strict priority. I have one that's labeled as not covered this semester that I'm just going to mention briefly, so you don't get trapped in the real world. If you care about deadlines, do not, like, by caring about deadlines, I mean, like, if you're making a computer for a car, and when someone presses the brake pedal, it needs to respond in 10 milliseconds, don't use any of the schedulers we learned. There are special schedulers for those cases, such as an earliest deadline first scheduler. Yes? So does SRTF approximation mean multi-level feedback queue? So multi-level feedback queue is one of many SRTF approximations that are out there. And perhaps not the best one. Yes?
And why does it reduce I/O throughput?
So why does it improve I/O throughput? Because shortest remaining time first, we try to quickly run things that are going to do I/O. Versus things that aren't. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So that's on schedulers. So summary of things we've seen and one we haven't, that I just, please don't make hard real-time systems that use a scheduler that doesn't actually give you guarantees. So note on multi-core. So multi-core scheduling complicates things a lot, and we don't have time in this class, at least without sacrificing a bunch of other topics, to really talk about it. And there's big constraints which make these schedulers actually very tricky, and there's not like consensus on what the best way to design a multi-core scheduler is by a big margin. So one issue is that if we have multiple cores, we want two cores to be able to schedule things independently. We don't want to have them wait to sync up with each other all the time. We want to keep a process on one core because that's better for cache performance. And multi-core scheduling gives us choices we haven't seen. So like when we've looked at shortest remaining time first, we can just say, do we want to stop the thing that's running now from running? If we're looking at that in the multi-core setting, we have to say, which of the different things do I want to stop to run this thing, if any? So our decisions all become much more complicated. Sort of the common approach that you'll see schedulers do, but not the only approach, is to have a separate list of threads for each core, and to have some periodic thing, where periodic might mean like every second or something like that, that rebalances them to try to keep all the cores equally utilized. So that's one example of a style of approach you'd use to try to achieve these goals, but obviously you're making compromises, right? You aren't looking at all the data on each core when you do that, in exchange for making sure the cores don't need to wait for each other. So that's everything I have about schedulers, unless there's questions, comments. Yeah. Can I go to the slide about two-thirds? Yeah. In this case, why they were saying two-thirds? So they were saying two-thirds because they thought of the schedule where we enforce this time quantum, we don't preempt. So that means that A gets to run for 2 milliseconds every time B goes IO. Does that answer your question? Okay. So if we do preemption, that won't happen. And we should eventually. Okay, so our next topic is going to be about using threads. So we talked about scheduling threads, but so far the only way we've used multiple threads is with multiple processes. Sorry, question about.
I have a question about the previous slide on the AF, the 40% IPv1 0C.
Yeah.
So
you're saying it, could A get more than 60%
because
A keeps running? So if we have any sort of, so maybe if we don't do preemption at all, that might happen. Yes, but if we do preemption, then at some point B should be so far behind A that we should make the decision to run B instead. Right away. Does that make sense? So if we don't do preemption, I agree, yes, A could get more than 60%. Except maybe. So that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So let's talk about threads. So if we want to I'm talking about writing programs that use multiple threads in the same process. That's what we're going to be looking at for several weeks. And a good question is, why would you want to do this? Like, we can write multiple processes, and we can in fact pretty much do everything we can do with threads in the same process. And there's sort of two different things we're commonly doing when we write a multi-threaded piece of code. So one is what I'll call concurrency, that we want different things happening at the same time. So like if I'm writing a web server, I want to handle each user separately with a separate piece of code. If I'm writing a web browser, I want to have separate code running for each web page. I don't want to have one piece of code that handles all the web pages together. And this is not necessarily something about performance. So these are things we might want to do even if we know we're only ever going to run on one core, because it's just more convenient to program that way. It's more convenient to reason about, to have different threads for different tasks that are happening at the same time, even if we know they're all going to be scheduled on one core. So another sort of thing, reason we might want to use threads, is because we have one task to do, but we want to take advantage of more hardware resources to do it. So like if we're doing a simulation of something, you know, like classically like a weather simulation, you know, you might want to try to use all the processors you have to do it at the same time. And we're going to have our first threading assignment, which is going to be Conway's Game of Life, which is kind of like a simulation of sorts. And that's going to be using this parallelism idea. We're doing one big task, but we're doing it across multiple processors or multiple cores. And I'm mentioning this idea of thinking about why we want threads, because sometimes the answer is going to be you don't. And I would say probably a lot of the time the answer is going to be you don't. We're going to talk a lot about how to use threads, but that doesn't mean you should do that. Especially if you're in this concurrency space, there's probably a way of doing it without threads, which may or may not be more convenient, because as we'll see, there's lots of issues with threads which make reasoning about correctness difficult. And we'd sure like our code to be correct most of the time. Okay. And, yes, question?
What is parallelism address when a program has dependencies later on in the program that you need to compute things before and after? Like, how do you get multiple parts of the program at the same time?
Question, how do we do all the parts of the program at the same time when a program needs the other? We'll talk about that a lot more later. Other questions? Okay. So we're going to talk about one particular way of using threads, of implementing threads. And that's sort of the assumption I'm going to sort of work in explaining how threads work. And this model is going to be what I'll call kernel threads. This means that the operating system scheduler deals with all the threads of your process. This is not the only threading design that's out there, and used to not be the most popular one. These days, it's what you'll see. So it used to be the case that instead you'd have a scheduler that scheduled processes, and the process would have this library that scheduled multiple threads within that process. We're going to not look at that model. We're going to look at the model where the OS knows all the threads you have and schedules them in one place, where we don't have a hierarchy of schedulers. And the reason why these hierarchies of schedulers have gone out of fashion is because it seems primarily because they're a little awkward with multiple cores. That it's nice to have one thing handle how to divide up the threads among cores rather than having to split that responsibility somehow. And we alluded to earlier that threads, you know, have some thread state that is kept in our thread control block, and there are processes kept in a process control block, and a process can have multiple threads. This is not something XV6 supports, but this is something modern OSs supports. And this model is actually maybe not the best description of how Linux and some other similar OSs actually support this. So Linux has something that looks like a thread control block that kind of also looks like a process control block. And the way it works is it has pointers to things like the list of open files. And multiple threads can happen to share a list of open files and an address space and things like that. And the idea is that if you do If you have two threads that don't share anything, they're separate processes. If you have two threads that share everything that they can share, then they're two threads of the same process. So on Linux, the creating a new thread is just done with this variant of fork, where you just say, what things do you want to copy? When you're doing fork, you say, yeah, I want to copy nothing. When you're doing creating a thread, you say, I want to not copy as much as possible. In which case, you end up with pointers to all the same things, the same list of open files, the same address space, and so on. Yes?
How does this relate to struct proc?
So Linux's task structure is the closest equivalent to struct proc. And so this would be like in struct proc, rather than having an array of open files, we would have a pointer to an array of open files, and two processes could have, two threads or tasks could have the same pointer. For example. Yes?
So this is
what question is, this is Linux equivalent to x86 struct proc? Yes. And it works in this way where you can have two threads that share everything, in which case they're same threads in the same process, or share nothing, in which case they're separate processes, or anything in between. Yes?
How can the fork create new threads without processes?
How can a fork create new threads without processes? So the difference is just whether we have the task struct have two pointers to the same thing, in which case there's threads, or we make copies of the things that are pointed to. Does that answer your question?
But does it create new threads or processes?
Does fork create new threads or processes? Fork creates a new process.
So then what do you mean by new threads?
And a new process will have a new thread. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so fork does create a new thread, but it primarily creates a new process that happens to need a new thread. Yes?
Is clone still going to give us like a new PID or something?
Is clone going to give us a new PID? So something I kind of gloss over on this slide is that Linux has separate thread IDs and process IDs, and one of the options to clone is whether you create a new process ID. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and I think they call the process IDs like thread group IDs, but basically, yeah, there's a separate thread ID and process ID, and clone determines whether you clone that or not. Yes?
So does this support multi-threading then?
Question, does this support multi-threading? Yes, because we can create a new thread that shares everything, so it's in the same process.
So this is a parallelization.
So question, would I use this for parallelization or concurrency? You'd use this for both. It's good for both cases. It's just a question of what does the thread do after a clone. Does that answer your question?
They don't have separate structures for each of the use cases.
They don't have separate structures for use cases? Yes. So all these use cases are just what are you doing in the code you run? Yes. So question, if I fork a multi-threaded process, what happens? Only the thread that calls fork is in the new process. Only a copy of the thread that called fork is in the new process. If you have a multi-threaded process and you call fork, the thread that called fork is copied into the new process. No, none of the other threads are.
So
yeah.
Also, for the thread, when do you just use a thread? When do you just use a fork? Because it seems like fork can basically replace threads.
So question, when do you use threads, when do you use fork? So the main advantage of using threads is that we have shared memory, that variables that are in one thread can be accessed from another, which is, I guess, both an advantage and a disadvantage, as we'll see. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And a secondary advantage, I guess I should say, is that like files in one thread can be accessed from another like directly. Okay, so this is the low-level API. We are never going to write a call to clone. Instead, we're going to use POSIX API which is not this, which uses, has this pthread create function. Or I guess before I should say that, I should mention the bottom point of this slide since I maybe didn't go over it. So the reason why Linux takes this approach is that threads and processes have the same logic in the scheduler. There's no difference. A thread, two threads in the same process look the same to the scheduler as two threads in different processes. The only difference is when we look up, like, what files do you have open, we happen to get to the same place for the two threads that are in the same process. Okay, so POSIX has a way of creating threads. It's not clone. There's this pthread create function. And pthread create takes a place to store a thread ID, which is stored in this pthread key type. It takes some options, which we will leave as null for most of our examples. It takes a function to run the thread. So unlike fork, where like it returns twice, here we're not going to do that. Pthread create is going to run a particular function in the new thread. And that function, in this case, is going to be compute pi for this first example. And we also specify an argument to pass to the function. We always have the function take a void star argument and return a void star. The idea of this is that you can convert any pointer you want to a void star so you can pass anything to the thread this way. In this case, I have nothing interesting to pass, so I'm just going to pass null, and I create two threads, two thread IDs. And when I run this, what's going to happen is, well, I'm going to call pthread create. That's going to start running compute pi right away, just like forking started running the new process right away. And I call pthread create the second time, it's going to start running print class list right away. And they'll both run at the same time as my main function keeps running. Yes? Don't I need to define what pthread is to not get an exception or some sort of error? Since we're passing a pointer to pthread, pthread create is going to write to it. So rather than returning the ID, we pass it in to be filled in. Pass a pointer to it to be filled in. Yes?
What's the advantage of doing this over just forking off a child?
What's the advantage of doing this over forking off a child? So as I mentioned earlier, the main advantage is that this shares local variables, like global variables, with our original process. It also is going to share open files. I guess from a performance point of view, another advantage is that creating a thread is usually less expensive than creating a process, because we don't have to have like separate memory. Okay. Yes?
Does the order of creating each thread matter?
Does the order of creating threads matter? So, not particularly. It doesn't. There's certainly no guarantee that compute pi will actually run before print class list. Just like with forking two processes, that wouldn't be guaranteed. Yes, back there? How do I know which thread I'm currently in? So there is a function to get your current thread ID if you want it, but most commonly, I know that compute pi is only called when I create that thread, and that's how I keep track of that information. Does that answer your question? Do threads tend to wait on each other? Yes, and we'll see how later. We'll see, in fact, like four different ways how. Yes?
Forking creates new processes and pthread creates new threads.
Question, forking creates new processes and pthread creates new threads? Yes. And it happens that creating a new process means creating a new thread, just because we can't really run anything without a thread. Yes? So question, if I was parallelizing compute pi, would I just pass the same reference? So we need to figure out how to divide up that problem of computing pi, which maybe is not so trivial. And in that case, we'd like, and we'll see some strategies for how do I have start multiple threads and have them do different things in a bit. We'll see several different ways of doing that. So that's a good question, like how do I start different threads that do, you know, similar but different things, rather than completely different things like here. Like without like writing three different versions of the code. Okay, so we have this pthread create call. So pthread create's argument, we have the thread identifier, we have the function to run, and we have our thread attributes, which we're gonna leave as null. This, we can set some extra settings. We'll see some examples later, and so on. Okay. So that's p-thread create. So here I have some code which uses p-thread create, and I run this function print message, which prints in the thread and returns. And it prints that out about 4% of the time. So what happened? Yes.
But you didn't wait for the thread, so before the thread got executed, your main program was active.
Yeah, so what happens, and this is really subtle, is that returning from main, this is the same as calling xset with 0. Returning 0 from main is the same thing as calling xset with 0. And xsets the whole process, all the threads. So sometimes main returned 0 first, and therefore we exited before the thread ran. And sometimes we didn't. And it turned out on my system, the way the timing worked out, about 96% of the time, main finished executing before the thread managed to print, and 4% of the time was the other way around. And we have what we might know as a race condition, that depending on who's faster, you get very different results. Yes? How do we guarantee that it will complete? We'll have that on the next slide. Other questions? Okay. So how do we guarantee it completes? So there's a pthread function for doing that. It's called pthread join. So this function waits for it and also collects its return value. We, in fact, aren't using the return value, but that might come in handy later. So the null argument is, you know, place to put return value. Return value, we just say we don't care about the return value, but this importantly waits for the thread to finish. So this is kind of equivalent to wait PID. Questions? Yes. Question, when people are doing multi-threaded code, do they use the return value? Do they modify a global variable? It varies. I don't think there's a consensus. Or there's a third option we'll see, which is you can like modify like a pointer that's passed in to the thread. Yes? Question, does this wait for all the threads? This waits for the thread specified as thread with the ID specified as the argument. So I have the thread ID here that was set by pthread create. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Is there a generalized argument that will allow you to just wait for every?
Is there a way to, like, so with wait PID, we could specify -1 to wait for all children. Is there an equivalent for pthread join? No. If you don't keep track of what threads you started, you're out of luck. And if you want to wait for multiple threads, you know, whichever one comes first, you have to come up with your own mechanism for that. And we'll see some options for doing that later. Yes?
So instead of pthread join, can I just have a while loop, like a while true loop over there without working?
So question, if I just had like an infinite loop, would that prevent it from main from exiting before the thread does? Yes. Probably would have some other side effects that aren't so great, like using a lot of CPU time. But yeah, that would sort of solve the problem by creating a different problem of your program hanging. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
Do you have a main function in the thread?
Do I have a main function in the thread? So the thread starts running in the print message function because that's what we passed as an argument to pthread create. Does that answer your question?
No main function.
So that is the equivalent of main.
But then when that function returns 0, is it actually?
So when that function returns, does it exit the process? No. So Returning from that function does not call xSet, because it's not called the way main is. Yes?
If there's two threads and one thread is waiting for it to do something, is there a way in thread one to say, hey, OS, come back later, like wait without getting
ready? So if one thread's waiting for another, is the way for which thread to? So is there a way to say schedule me again later? So there are there's ways of saying schedule me n seconds later. There is a call to say don't schedule me now, schedule something else, and get back to me. But which is I think there's a scheduled in POSIX, but this won't stop you from using a lot of CPU time because it basically ends your time quantum, but you'll go back to your time quantum as usual, which is not very useful for most things. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So you said the scheduler treats all threads like the same, whether or not they're from one process, the same process or different process. How does the scheduler know if that process is exited for like that?
Question, I said the scheduler on Linux treats the threads the same for all, no matter what process they're from. So how does it know when exited? So the implementation of the exit system call on Linux handles the multi-threaded part. But it's not the scheduler that's different. Does that answer your question? So basically, there's different versions of the exit system call on Linux, and one of them scans for things that are part of the same process. And other OSs might have different solutions for this. Other questions? Okay, so there's one other way we could say, like, not wait for it. Another solution, which is not recommended, but just to tell you how threads work. So main, like, is called by this. So basically, our problem is that there's some code which calls main and passes the result to xSet. So if main can just not return, we can fix that. And there's a special function, pthread_exit, which exits the current thread without exiting the whole process. And in effect, pthread_create, like just like main is called and uses the return value to call exit, pthread_create uses the return value of what the thread function to call pthread_exit, which is exits the current thread only. So this would also solve the problem, but I don't recommend it over joining, because it usually provides many non-intuitive effects. So we have these two functions, pthread join, waits for a thread and retrieves its return value. I should not write return, I should say gets its return value because it returns it via a pointer. So it's like wait PID, but for thread. And the return value is a pointer, a void star, rather than an int. Pthread_exit exits the current thread, returning a particular value. It's the same effect as returning from the thread function, just like exiting is the same effect as returning from main. Yes?
Is that the same functionality as just returning from the function, or why does it exist at all? Is it so that we can...
Why does it exist at all? The same sort of reason why exit exists when you could just return from main. It's more convenient in some cases.
Would you use it like at some point that was not at the end of the function call?
Would I use it at some point not at the end of the function call? I wouldn't recommend it, but you absolutely can. Yes?
What is a void pointer?
What is a void pointer? So a void star, this represents pointer to anything. And the typical usage is that you will cast a pointer to something to a void star and then cast it back. Or actually, you'll cast it from a void star to the back. You technically in C, you don't need to cast to void star. You can just put a pointer in a void star and then take it out by casting. Does that answer your question?
Why do you need to cast it to void and cast it back?
So in C, you don't need to cast it to void, but you need to cast back, because otherwise you're using the pointer as the wrong type, and the compiler just has a rule that it wants you to be explicit about that. Yes? So pthread exit is the same effect as returning from a function that you pass to pthread create. Main is not passed to pthread create as a special case. So main is run by some code which effectively does calls main and calls exit with main's return value. Other questions? Okay. So we know about creating and stopping threads, so let's look at like doing useful things with threads. So here I have an array of values and two result variables. And I'm gonna sum this up in that parallelism way. We're gonna split the work up between two threads. I have my simple solution where I've decided I'm gonna have one function to sum the first half of the array and one function to sum the second half. So this function does 0 through 512. This does 512 through 1024. And I have my global arrays of values and two places to put the results. And rather than these threads returning the results, I'll just put the result in that results array at index 0 or index 1. So what I do, you know, I have those in the results array. So what I do is I create the two threads with my two different functions. I wait for them to finish. And then I sum up the two results. And on a multi-core system, the two sums should happen on two different cores. So it might be faster. Probably not with just 512 things, but if it was big enough, it would be faster. Okay, so questions? Yes? What if I created one thread for every single number? Then they would all try to run in parallel, but probably we don't have that many cores, and probably there's a lot of time spent starting and stopping threads. Okay, so let's think about how this works for memory layout. So I have my global variables, and they're stored sort of in my global data region. And I'm gonna create two threads which have their own thread control blocks, which have their own registers, and they're gonna have a pointer to two new stacks. So we're gonna create a new stack for each thread. And we have one address space, so it's gonna be accessible in the same address space. We're gonna choose some memory location for the new stacks. Okay. So that's how they're gonna run. So questions about our memory layout here, about us having two new stacks created that have different addresses from our original stack. Yeah?
Does the stacks sort of grow in the same direction?
Question, do the stacks grow in the same direction? So the stacks grow downwards. Generally, a property of stacks for threads is that usually we will set some relatively small size for them, and if you try to use more stack space than that, well, things won't work well. That answer your question?
So would there be stack collisions if there's like two threads?
Would there be stack collisions? So usually we'll allocate some space between the stacks. So you'll get a crash from accessing invalid memory if you go over the stack limit. Does that answer your question? Okay. So, what was particularly inelegant about this is I had two different functions. So my program counter is pointed to a sum back and sum front. And we really like not to duplicate code, which is very similar. So how can we do that? So here I'm gonna write one sum function, and it's gonna take in an index, which is gonna be 0 or 1 in this case. And I'm going to use that index to compute the for loop indices. So I just use that ID to say my beginning and end of my for loop. And I have to pass that through a void pointer. So what I've decided to do is I convert an integer to a pointer and then convert it back with a cast. So rather than having it be a pointer to something, it's just an integer converted to a pointer, and then I convert the integer back from the pointer. And now I just have a loop to create two threads and start two threads. Code lurks. So questions? So I have my same global variables. I just am assigning, rather than having a front and a back version, I just have one version that takes in this parameter that the p3 create function lets me pass through. Yes? Can you see the memory layout slide? Sure. Can I see the assembly? What about the assembly?
Oh, no, like the hex and how that works.
What, the hex values? I chose typical values, but that's, like, we don't know the detail of numbers, if that's what you're asking, about the hex values on here. Okay, so questions about this example here? Okay, so one strategy here is I have a bunch of related threads, I just pass in a number. So what if I want to pass more information than that? You know, what if I want things to be more dynamic? So here I've like kind of, I had to like simplify my notion of what to do to this one number. Can I do better? And we'll have an example of that next. So question first, yes.
So why don't you have to dereference the pointer?
Why don't I have to dereference the pointer? So it's not actually a pointer, it's just an integer that I've converted to a pointer. Yeah, so I just, rather than storing an address in it, I've stored a number that I'm pretending is an address. Yes?
Can you pass in a pointer to an integer in this case as well?
Could I pass in a pointer to an integer? Yes, but I need to make sure I pass in two different integers to each thread.
Oh, I see.
But yes, I could do that, but I need to make sure each thread gets its own integer, not two pointers to the same integer. So here's a strategy where I'm going to pass more information. So I'm going to pass a start and end location to the thread, and I'm also going to pass a pointer to where to put the result. So now, the only global variable I'm using is the values one. So I have this global values array, and I make these structs for this thread info, which has the start and end and result variable for each thread, on the stack of the main thread. And then I pass that to the threads as their argument using pthread create. And I have them use that pointer to write the result in a place where I can later on read it down here. So I just read it from I pass them a pointer to the thing to fill in. They filled it in for me with the result. Then I can read the results after they finish. So questions about works? Yes? Can I pass in multiple arguments to the thread? Pthread create doesn't support that. It always has to take a single void star and return a single void star. So if you want to pass in multiple arguments, you need to make a struct like here. That's how you'll work around it. Other questions? Okay, so if we think of our memory layout, what happens here is my main thread stack, I have my info array, and the two threads I create have pointers to different parts of that array that they're accessing, and that's fine because everything's sharing the same memory. Yes? What are all the dashes in between each of the individual parts? What do you mean, the dashes? What are the shading in between the sections? Those represent memory that is inaccessible. Yes. So typically, there will be some space between the stacks so that if you have a stack overflow, it will crash rather than doing something else. Or will hopefully crash most of the time rather than doing something else. Isn't that significantly big? I made it so it's clear that there's space that may not reflect the actual layout. Okay, so that's an example of that. And we also could say, rather than having values be an array, we could pass a pointer to it in the same way that we pass the start and end location. So questions about this before I finish up? And in this case, values could be anywhere. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today.